All right. Hello, everybody. What is going on? We are live right now. Stephen Ignoramus here, and welcome to Call Me Ignorant. It is episode number 56 of the show, January 16th, 2020. So pleased you're here with me. We're streaming live to many different platforms right now. And if you can't catch the show live, you can find it after the fact on BitChute and FreedomScoop.com, as well as YouTube, Mixer, Twitch, things like that. Call Me Ignorant is also available in podcast format on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and Podbean. With me on the program today is Adam Kokesh. Adam is a pragmatic libertarian and a combat veteran who is running for president of the United States in 2020 on the platform of localizing and dissolving the federal government and finally freeing America. You can find his information linked below in the show description and over at thefreedomline.com or at kokeshforpresident.com. You can find all of his information on the presidential platform, book, blog, and contact information. His YouTube channel is also linked below, where he stays pretty active with on-the-street interviews and in-studio rants. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Adam Kokesh. Welcome to Call Me Ignorant.
Hey, thank you so much for the opportunity, Stephen. And I really appreciate that you got the interview introduction correct there with framing this presidential campaign, because a lot of times people introduce me and it's like, oh, he's a presidential candidate. I go, no, well, you know, hold on a second, hold on. Yeah, but not the psychopath kind, because my platform includes resigning on day one.
Yes.
And getting rid of this unjust power that shouldn't exist. So I don't have to reframe things, and I appreciate you putting it that way.
Well,
right from the
Well, what's interesting about that is when I saw your, you know, I've been following your work for just over a year and a half or something like that. But when I looked over at your Twitter profile, it says pragmatic libertarian. And one of my first questions was going to be, what is an unpragmatic libertarian?
Well, there is a very powerful ideal and that is presented by libertarians. I know you're trying. I should have like a more rah-rah libertarian answer to that. But I'll get to that part. I promise.
Yeah, yeah.
No, there are people who like I do take that ideal very seriously, the ideal of a voluntary society, of a free society, a libertarian, someone who believes in freedom, what you have when no one is forcing their will on you, when your rights are respected, when you get to live in peace and harmony with everyone around you. So this is described philosophically as voluntarism. The ideal where all human relationships are voluntary, free of force, fraud, and coercion. And this suggests a world where humanity is able to meet our potential without the harmful effects of violence, with nothing but win-win relationships instead of win-lose relationships with coercion and violence involved. So there are some libertarians, and we all like to say there's, you're only a real libertarian if you think you're the only real libertarian, because there is something important to point out here behind that for people who don't know about the psychology of this is that the becoming libertarian in a conscientious, deliberate way, while everybody's libertarian, they just haven't figured it out yet. And it really is a big chunk of the population already. It does mean breaking away from the mainstream. It does mean separating from the status quo. It does mean condemning the existing authority and power structure that society is organized under today. And so there's a certain, oh, whoa, hey, I'm standing on different ground now. I crossed that line in the sand. I'm on the side of ethics and righteousness and justice. And there are a lot of libertarians, myself included, we go through a kind of reactionary phase. You see, I'm wearing my Iraq Veterans Against the War hoodie. You know, that was a big part of it for me, coming back from Iraq, going, I just watched Marines die in combat based on lies. And if the American people all knew just my story, less people would die in the future. And there's this, whoa, I got to get this story out. I got to do this. I got to address this. There are people suffering at the hands of government all over the world. Now I understand it. Now I want to do something about it. And you see a lot of need to differentiate the individual intellectually. Well, I'm this kind of libertarian, and at some point you just kind of get over all of that. And a lot of people like yourself, hopefully get to learn from my mistakes and go through that process a lot faster. And what it means to me to be pragmatic is to apply principle consistently. A lot of libertarians get hung up on one particular principled aspect of it, and they forget that, well, we also have to apply specialization of labor to specialization of leadership. We can't just wait for every single American to agree with us on everything. No, we have to create practical policy that unites people around these principles. And so this is how I came to localization, which is taking governments apart from the top down, getting them back to the community level, because a community is something that is fundamentally voluntary. You choose to be a part of a community. You can choose to leave at any time. And instead of saying government this, government that, this isn't a political message. I've screwed this up for many years, thinking of libertarianism as a political message. It's not. It's a message of ethics, a philosophy of love and respect for your fellow human beings. And getting to get past that political game, you stop saying, well, it's this issue or that issue. Look, you
the
can have
thing.
As much.
Yeah,
yeah, it was, but it's, you can have as much or as little government as you want, as long as it's voluntary, as long as you don't force it on anyone or hold anybody captive, as long as you let people choose to opt out from your system. Some people, you know, I'm going to want to live on 10 acres, you know, with my homestead and my family in mountains in Arizona and, you know, pretty much be left alone by geographic government. But I want to be part of a community there. I want to be part of global systems of communication and insurance and commerce. And I want to be richly engaged in all of that. And that's a lot more pragmatic than trying to argue ideals or hold people to your ideals. Localizing government, it's the everybody gets what they want strategy. You want this community, cool. You want that community, cool. I want you to have that right.
Right. And so I have your information linked below in the show description. It says it right on your website, basically, that on day one, if elected, you would go in there, resign from being president. And what's the title? Custodian of the federal government? That's what you would adopt?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Very appropriate terminology for a number of reasons. Yes. Custodian of the federal government is the term that we have come up with for my role as bankruptcy agent of the federal government. Quite a mess to clean up, also
yes.
A very really humble term. But yeah, the process is to go in, and I would do one thing only as president, aside from the ceremony, swearing in, who knows, march down Pennsylvania Avenue. I'm not big on tradition and ceremony and you know, the pomp and circumstance of all of that, but you know, whatever. There's one thing I would do in exercising the authority of the presidency, and it's really the only legitimate power, which is to remove the burden of the state in the case of the pardon. And I would be pardoning everybody who is facing federal charges or imprisoned in federal prisons for victimless crimes.
Okay.
So anything that's you know, drugs. You have the right to decide what you put in your own body. That's a victimless crime. For whistleblowing, you know, there are a lot of people now who face federal charges, and they have all sorts of excuses for whistleblowers. So Ross Ulbricht, Ed Snowden, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, reality winner. There's a handful of other, you know, high profile ones that I should be able to rattle off better to score political points. But no, those are the big ones, and you know, you get the idea. But then I sign one executive order in which I resign. We declare the Constitution null and void. The federal government is officially bankrupt at that point. Federal laws cease being enforced immediately, and
wow.
We begin the process of a peaceful, orderly, responsible bankruptcy that leaves us with 50 independent states and up to 562 sovereign native nations. Now, this is radical in the best sense of the word, striking at the root. And I would remind you of Henry David Thoreau, for every 1,000 striking at the branches of evil, there is one striking at the root. But in a sense, this is still a very moderate platform in terms of policy. Most people don't know this. I'll put you on the spot, Stephen. How many people work for government in the United States directly as well?
Federal government?
No, the government, the entire government,
Oh
state,
my God.
local, and federal.
I want to say that I think that 200,000 work for the federal. So is it what, something like 5 million? Something like that?
Interesting, your ballpark there on the proportions, but no, it is 3 million that work for the federal government.
Oh my gosh.
22 million.
Are you serious?
All three levels of government, 22 million. So I'm talking about eliminating 3 million government jobs out of 22 million. That's less than 1/7 of the government workforce. Do the math. 3 times 7, 21, 22 million. Now, a lot of those are going to be apportioned to the states. A lot of them are going to be rehired. I don't know how many. It's going to depend on state governments. What they want, certainly a significant chunk of the military, as it's apportioned out, will be, and that's about 1 million active duty personnel. Although I hope that we transition within this to the founders' vision of the national defense, based on decentralized militia-based defense rather than the standing armies
Yeah,
that they
I was
approach.
going to ask about that. So a militia system where the states, each state contributes a certain number, or they just, it's all voluntary. It's whoever the state agrees on. If it's zero, it's zero, right?
Well, hold on, Stephen. I'm explaining how moderate my platform is here. And before I get to that, I will say it's also very moderate in the sense that every state now as a sovereign gets to do whatever they want.
Right.
You live in a liberal state, you're a conservative, you live in a conservative state, right away you get more of what you want. So to answer your question with the military directly, slow down one step at a time. Yes, I see this ideal. I'm a principled idealist. I'm also a pragmatist. So when I see this ideal of there should be no systems at all in society that are coercive, period, end of story. Nothing should be socialized. Nothing should be run by a coercive monopoly that is government as we know it today. I'm not an anarchist. I used to identify as an ANCAP, but it's not really accurate because, again, I want you to be able to have as much or as little government as you want as long as it's voluntary. And the question for me is not how do we eliminate all government? It's how do we eliminate coercive government and transition what's left to voluntary systems? So while yes, the founders had this ideal of a voluntary decentralized militia-based system. And it wasn't necessarily a state militia, but community militias, individuals that constituted this larger abstract concept of the militia, a rifle behind every blade of grass, right? A well-armed population that refuses to be governed by anyone. That's the real militia. And when I say slow down, Stephen, let's be moderate here, one step at a time. No, I'm not going to have or pretend to have the authority. I'm not asking the American people for the
Yes.
authority to do anything at the state level or more local than that, other than in my own advocacy, like education, for example. We're going to get rid of the Department of Education. That's easy. It's a bureaucratic organization that doesn't run a single school, educate a single child. And my advocacy is for community-based, voluntary, market-based systems of education that the government should have nothing to do with, really obvious. But states are still going to exist with state departments of education. Government schools are still going to be the dominant paradigm. I'm going to just get rid of this one layer of regulation and waste at the top and get the ball rolling towards that decentralized ideal. So with the military, close all foreign bases, bring all the troops home immediately. That's easy. First step in the process. The next step, though, is to separate what's legitimate offensive weaponry from defensive weaponry. So nuclear weapons out. And that's one of my favorite parts of this platform. We are getting rid of the nuclear arsenal. It is going to be de-weaponized and returned to the American people through the AmeriCoin auction process of returning all the liquidating assets of the federal government for industrial purposes. So totally de-weaponize the nukes. And then long range bombers, drones, nuclear submarines, aircraft carriers. Those aren't defensive weapons. You know, they justify it with all sorts of ridiculous excuses. Projecting power to be able to attack and destroy in someone else's land is not defensive. But, you know, missile defense, tanks, anti-aircraft, individual, personnel, those things will then be apportioned among the states. And so you're going to have states with their national guards basically transitioning to sovereign militaries. But they are going to be much more defense-oriented rather than empire-oriented as we have today. That's the real important shift.
Wow. All right. Since we're talking about the military, why don't we go back to your story a little bit? I mean, so you're a combat veteran, and did you start thinking these type of positions while you were still serving, or did it happen afterwards?
Yeah, I wish I wasn't so naive, Stephen, and I could say, yeah, while I was there, I saw the death and destruction firsthand and figured it all out. No.
So you bought in, and sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I by and large, but I, in order to explain, I have to back up and tell my whole story of awakening of ideological development, because it relates to that. My mom was vaguely liberal. She's from Canada. Don't tell anybody I'm half Canadian. Although they'll think of me like Ted Cruz, though, might actually be Canadian.
Yeah.
So I was born in San Francisco. We have the paperwork. The birth certificate is clear. There's no. But yeah, my mom's from Montreal, and so it's my Jewish side as well. I'm half Jewish and half Canadian. Better keep that a secret. She was vaguely liberal. My dad grew up in on a ranch in Wyoming, and he was vaguely conservative. But they were both very distinctly anti-authority. And I was raised with a healthy distrust of power and a drive to question all things. They taught me to question themselves as parents, and that was, really an incredible gift. So because they weren't of a political consciousness with those things, I still fell for the military propaganda and enlisted at age 17. I actually went to Devil Pups at 14, which they send kids to instead of juvie sometimes. I went by choice because my parents had a friend who was a former Marine and a big booster of this program. So when I was 14 years old, I got my first big dose of militarism with Devil Pups. That's from Devil Dogs, Teufelhunden. The Marines' favorite nickname for themselves. And I identified as a libertarian at some point in high school when some teacher said, "All right, so are you a Republican or Democrat?" And I was like, whoa, I don't have a choice. I have to be lame. No, this is America. This is America. There's got to be an alternative. And they're like, well, there's these libertarians. They like to be left alone. And as a punk kid, I was like, yep, sign me up for that. But I enlisted at 17 in the reserves. I was expected to go to college. So I wanted to do my enlisted time as a reservist in college and then go officer. Did boot camp, MCT, advanced artillery training. And then while I was in college, I organized libertarians of the Claremont colleges, but I still didn't get it. I got libertarianism as a political message, the socially liberal, fiscally conservative. And this is why I'm so passionate about presenting libertarianism correctly, as opposed to this, I don't even want to say watered down. It's a perverted political version. When you say, well, I believe in this and this issue and this and this. No. You believe in one issue as a libertarian, and that's freedom.
Yeah.
The philosophy of self-ownership, the non-aggression principle of ethics. This is so central to what we're talking about. And if I had gotten the message that way, I would not have enlisted. I would not have volunteered to go to combat. And I think it's really important that people communicate those principles directly without feeling bullied or pressured into politicizing a message that is a much more beautiful deeper message than anything political ever possibly could be. This isn't politics. This is anti-politics.
Right.
So I volunteered for Fallujah with the Civil Affairs team in 2004. I was there for the first battle in April, the siege. And when I believed in what I went to an anti-war protest for the invasion. I was against going into Iraq, even in my naive militarism at the time. I saw that that was not a good idea, that this was going to not, America was going to lose on this one. Like, just no, going into Iraq, bad idea.
Yeah.
But I believed the general narrative still. I believed the propaganda, and I believed that what we were doing was cleaning up our mess afterwards. So civil affairs was important for me. I came back from Iraq 2004, first time I could afford it, $1,000, got my lifetime membership in the Libertarian Party. And I played Michael Bednarik, the 2004 nominee, in a debate in college, mock debate. They let the Libertarians play at the college level, even though they never let us play at the national level, or haven't yet.
Cool.
I should say. And then I got out of the Marine Corps after getting in trouble for bringing a pistol back. And so I was disgruntled enough to really start questioning things. And I joined Iraq Veterans Against the War. And at the time it was like, I know I'm a libertarian. I know I'm right about everything. I just have to prove it. And being surrounded by lefties, led to a lot of interesting arguments. And it led to me getting deeper in the philosophy. But then it was when I was running for Congress as a Republican, and it's kind of embarrassing to say, but Ron, I have a good excuse. Ron Paul asked me to run as a Republican so I could have his support and endorsement and as part of his strategy. So while I was running, I listened to the audiobook Ethics of Liberty by Murray Rothbard. And that's what took me to the bottom of the rabbit hole. And then I guess that would answer your question, but just to finish then, I couldn't shut up when the race was over, so I got a radio show, and that was the birth of Adam versus the Man on AM 1550 KIVA, more positive talk radio, Albuquerque. And then it got picked up as a TV show, Adam versus the Man on RT America in DC. And I've just been, independent since then. I've been shadow banned everywhere, censored a lot of different ways, as I'm sure you're familiar with the challenges as an independent media producer. But I love it. My journey to where I'm at now of, someone the other day referred to themselves as a Kokesh libertarian. And I hear that more and more often. And that's like, well, if you're calling yourself a Kokesh libertarian, maybe you're not getting the message, because you should just be a libertarian, not identify with a person or anything. But there is something that is unique about this perspective that I've developed over time of, being about the absolute ideal of a voluntary society, and localization is the way to get there. There really isn't anybody of any significant prominence, at least, directly advocating for voluntarism through localization as a practical policy of achieving it. There are a lot of people who have talked about secession. Tom Woods did a great has done several great podcasts on the subject. A lot of people with Mises Institute have talked about this, but really specifically as decentralizing government the way that I'm describing it, taking it apart from the top down, and being a threat now as a presidential candidate, having drawn the line in the sand. Some people would say I've carved out a unique intellectual space for myself.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that this is one of the debates that gets brought up the most with libertarians is, can you change something corrupt from the inside? Or do you starve it by not participating in it at all? You got your non-voting ANCAPs, you got your, use the vote type thing. But it seems that the president has just been given so much power over 100 years that there's only one way you could probably do it is someone become president and reverse the whole thing like you're talking about, right?
Yeah, no, and I'm sympathetic with a lot of those arguments, but let me address the argument from agorism first, because I can pretty much mathematically prove that it's wrong with a couple of examples. Now, I'm an agorist in the sense that I practice agorism. I believe it's an ethical means of engaging economically, saying that we do our best to withdraw material support from the state to pay as to allow as little to be stolen from us in taxation as possible, because taxation is theft, and encouraging other people to do the same, to work under the table. I am 100% for it. I am an agorist in every sense. In fact, I would dare say more than most keyboard warriors out there advocating for agorism, you know, living off grid, living the way that I do. I think I do a pretty good job of living short of the fully aesthetic. You know, I'm going to be a monk in a cave in the mountains. You know, aside from that fully aesthetic lifestyle, excuse me, I'm pretty darn agorist. But how many Americans were allowed by percentage to vote in the first constitutional presidential election?
Not many, right? Not a big percentage, right?
You didn't expect a dumb presidential trivia game this morning, did you? No, it was about 2% white landowning males.
Yeah.
And that was where, you know, American democracy started. And the government didn't say, oh, shucks, we don't have a mandate, we got to go home and just dissolve this thing. No, they said, cool, 50%+ of 2% voted for us, we're in charge, screw y'all.
Right.
Point guns at people. Now we're the authority here. And so the non-voting strategy isn't going to work by itself. You could get 95% of the population practicing agorism, and if 5% still believe in statism and you do nothing to directly oppose them, they will gather the resources to elect a significant government. They will hire enough people with guns. They will still be a threat. Now, that's not really realistic. Obviously, we get 95% of the population on board with agorism. Government ends a whole lot of other beautiful different ways. But there is the problem with the idea of the collapse as well. And I'm all for it. You know, call me a collapsitarian of last resort if you have to. But I'm proposing that we do things the easy way, not the hard way. And you can hope the government spares you and it's violent death throes as it desperately clings to power if it should come to a kind of economic collapse. And obviously, it's not sustainable.
Yeah.
The federal government isn't going to last forever. The financial arrangements that it finds itself in might end it in a kind of collapse anyway. The problem with that is that we don't really get our stuff back if that happens. And what I'm proposing, liquidating the federal government, we issue every single American 1,000 tokens of AmeriCoin, a digital currency that is your claim to the assets of the federal government. So right away, we're issuing a currency. You can think of it as a digital coupon. Every American gets 1,000 tokens. And then over the course of probably 10 years, we're going to auction off all of, like I said, the liquidating military assets, the buildings, the facilities, everything that doesn't get apportioned down to the states, and the land. 50% of the land in the Western states is owned by the federal government. We're going to parcel that out. Excuse me. Sorry, that's my Hillary Clinton moment. and return it to the American people as directly as possible. So if you wait for the collapse, you're still going to have these unnatural concentrations of wealth and power. If we have a way of avoiding that, of seeking real justice, I'm all for redistribution of wealth as long as it's back to the people it's been stolen from. Not for socialism, not for concentrated power under a government. But no, and this is where a lot of libertarians kind of forget, hey, how did government get this way? By stealing from us. If we want to really stand up for justice, we have to say we are going to return that stolen property as best we can. Well, I found a practical way of doing that with this platform, with this policy. And I think to ignore that does the American people a great disservice. What's been stolen from us is not just our freedom, not just our potential, but our birthright. The fact that all of this land is sitting there sequestered from being used by government when it should be returned to the American people, that's obscene. And in a way, what we are going to have is a kind of Fight Club leveling of the debt record. Because the dollar is soon going to become impotent as a national currency without the backing of the federal government, when the backing of AmeriCoin is this actual set of tangible assets that gives it value.
And that's a crypto that would be basically installed, for lack of a better word, on your, you know, as one of your first, you know, as part of your becoming the custodian of the federal government.
Right. Well, we're working with several experts right now on the technical details of this. Some have said, well, we might not be able to call this a cryptocurrency by some people who have a really strict definition of it, but it's going to function in many ways like a cryptocurrency. Every American will be issued 1,000 tokens by social security number. It'll be a secure digital currency that will act as your coupon, your redemption for these assets. It is not necessarily an enduring currency. We hope that we can build in a transitional function to it so it can eventually become truly decentralized. But because it is being controlled by the central bankruptcy authority, we might get to run it off the NSA servers, put them to good use for once, you know. But no, it will be at least starting as a centralized currency, specifically for the purpose of getting America through this bankruptcy process. It will function as a currency that will allow people to immediately, you will call it the freedom dividend. You're going to get a huge chunk of money in your pocket pretty much on day one here. This is you getting your birthright back that has been stolen from you.
Okay. So another question I had about this whole process is, you know, there is a question, a little bit of a question of national identity or something like that. Like right now there's a thing, there's many people in the country that don't identify as a Michigander or a, you know, Arizonian. They're an American, right? So I know that the state is not the same thing as the nation or the people, but a lot of people have that. The two are linked in their head. So like, I'm an American. If you make it a confederacy, it's just a bunch of states. You know, what if I want to be an American? You know, I like that there's an America. What do people just have to choose a state? Can they go on? I mean, I know you're a libertarian, so you're not in the business of policing what people think in their own brain. They're allowed to identify as an American if they live in Texas, but how do you, you know, and you could even call it a demographic thing, not necessarily skin color, but there might be, I don't know, there might be certain states that are more white or black, but how do you square the whole like demographics, nation, self national identity thing, which is a big thing these days with America, you know?
America. Yeah. I'm glad you raised the question that way, because I think it's kind of an unspoken objection to this platform that some people have. I mean, the thing I hear more than anything else on the trail, you know, we're traveling in No Force One, this giant campaign bus. And, you know, people stop and ask all the time, you know, what's this about? The thing I hear more often than anything else is some version of, I don't normally vote, but I'd come out and vote for that. So most Americans are not hung up on this identity thing. And it's an understandable dilemma, but it's very easy to break this psychological bind with just a little bit of rhetoric. And it says on the side of the bus right here, all the way across this 34-foot bus in big letters, we don't have to be united under one government to be united in American values. And on the front of the bus right up there above the windshield, it says, America is too good for this government. And we have been propagandized for so long in the language of the mainstream media of government itself. When the federal government does something, it doesn't say, hey, we, the federal government, screwed up a bunch of crap. We killed a bunch of innocent people. We stole or lost a bunch of money. We ripped you. No, America did. America invaded Iraq. Remember when America invaded? No, America did not invade Iraq. And this is a bit of a sidebar, but to the heart of the militarism issue, we are lied to from the beginning when we are told in school, wars are fought between countries. Bullshit. Wars are conducted by governments using violence to expand their protection rackets. That is the reality. It's not a country versus, no, the American government did something evil and corrupt. I can say we because I was part of the military. But no, for the I'm not just a stickler for the grammar of this, But it really is, are we using language that is our best available to accurately describe reality? The Dalai Lama was once asked, what's the first thing you would do if you were president? He said, I would start calling things by their true names. War is murder. Taxation is theft. Politicians are criminals. You know, let's be honest about it. So this identity of American is one that is really valuable to me, too. I'm not big on, you know, patriotism or national pride, but there is one thing about America that really does make me a patriot, which is that this country was founded on the idea of declaring your independence and overthrowing the biggest empire the world had ever seen. Now we get to do that again because the United States federal government is now the biggest empire the world has ever seen. And this idea of American is something that doesn't just belong to people who happen to be born inside this territorial area claimed by the federal government. That's nonsense. There are lots of people in this country who are un-American, who advocate deliberately against freedom or militarism, for the police state, for the surveillance state. They are un-American. What it means to be American and standing up for freedom, being able to and willing to put your life on the line for justice, that's what it means to be American. There are people outside of the borders of this country who are more American than people inside. There are people who identify deliberately outside of this country and say, America, the land of the free, the home of the brave, I want to be a part of that. They might not have noticed how far we've fallen to now, like number 20 or something on the World Freedom Index by most accounts. We're nowhere, we're not even near the top anymore. But just as an example, if being American has anything to do with committing civil disobedience, breaking unjust laws, standing up to authority, putting your life on the line, hey, there are 13 million illegals in this country who said, we don't even recognize the American government. That's how American we are.
Right.
To come here illegally is to be more American than the average American taxpayer who votes for Republicans and Democrats, who votes against their own freedom, who votes against Americanism. And there are people in this country who see that and want America to be American again in that deepest, truest sense. I want a different kind of American imperialism. I want the world to become America, not by submission to military, because that would be un-American, but by embracing these ideals. If America goes through what I'm suggesting here, we can lead the world forward in freedom again by getting government down to the community level. The rest of the world follows. Well, we're all Americans now.
So it's like influence it by example rather than, you know, blood overseas. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, you know, another common argument I've heard against proposals like yours and just libertarianism in general is, you know, people will say there's certain things the government just can't allow to happen. You know, if you could kick it to the states, like if enough stuff gets localized and gets put to the community level, you're going to maybe this is just the argument I've heard. You're going to see things like death by laziness. People are just not going to take care of each other. They're not going to pull the extra weight that the government's been pulling for so long. You know, in my opinion, bigger government does a shitty job with pretty much everything. But people make this argument, you know, people won't take care of each other. There won't be enough charities, or there won't be enough, you know, you know, big government has to pick up the slack. What do you like? What would you allow to happen if you saw some of these things happen? Would you still go through with your custodial services or what?
I think that assertion is not only absurd, but if I was capable of being offended, I would call that offensive. And that's because you have to understand, you know, what government is. When someone says you need government for this, until we get government to a voluntary state of localized community-based government, when someone says we need government for this, what they're saying is we need violence.
Yeah.
My ideas aren't good enough to convince people to be a part of. We have to force them on everyone. And to say, that humans aren't capable of coming together nonviolently to achieve whatever righteous things are necessary for a community. To me, I'm not offended, like literally, I'm not literally offended, because I used to make t-shirts that said being offended is fucking bullshit. So I'm not allowed to be offended because I call myself out too many times. No, but I don't believe in being offended. But in a sense, I'm offended for humanity when people say things like that, because not only are we living in the most peaceful times in human history, but what we've seen, and this is from the work of Harvard professor Steven Pinker, who did a great TED talk based on his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, called The Surprising Decline in Violence. He proves academically that violence follows a kind of decay curve over time, that we get more peaceful, more cooperative, that this is really fundamentally connected to life itself. Multicell organisms beat out single cell organisms, and human societies, communities that are able to cooperate are going to be able to outcompete those that are always at war and fighting amongst themselves. It's really that simple. This is the progress of humanity becoming less violent over time, more cooperative. If people don't want to do something, forcing them to do it at the barrel of a gun, as government does, is not an answer and always makes things worse. So that argument, you know, if someone were making that case that you're making here as a devil's advocate argument, would apply it to any issue, you would have to be really blatantly ignorant of historical reality, present reality, as to how those violent policies have unintended consequences and make things worse on a policy level. You can do the analysis. It's really clear. But at a deeper level, it is kind of offensive to hear people say, well, humans are so dumb and ignorant and lazy. We need government. We need Ubermensch to come in and point guns and leaders to take charge and force everybody into systems. Otherwise, that's just, I would suggest that the people to whom that argument has a genuine intellectual appeal are probably projecting some negative view of themselves. And it might be a lack of self-love, a lack of awareness of our state of humanity, of being lovers at core, that the highest state of human consciousness is love. And I hope I'm not sounding too much like Marianne Williamson, but in love, all things are possible. But no, in reality, yes, in freedom, humanity is capable of meeting our potential, and any violence holds us back from that.
Yeah, I mean... I mean, even if they were right that a certain percentage of people wouldn't take care of each other, or they wouldn't pick up the slack, the question is at that point, is it the job of the gun to do so? I would say no, right? It's still on people to kind of communities to figure it out for themselves, and a certain percentage are always going to slip through the cracks, whether it's private means or public means or.
Yeah, course no means. Giant social system is ever going to be perfect,
right?
Of course.
Cool. All right. So, I mean, so, you know, I guess what we could talk about next, I just wanted to know real fast, you know, about the thing that's happening in Virginia right now, where it's, you know, they just declared a state of emergency for a week. Do you know about that?
Yeah, no, I just covered that on my podcast last night, actually. And specifically, Governor Northam's declared state of emergency around the protest.
Yeah, man. It's crazy, right?
Banning all weapons around the. And so normally, you know, the encroachment of gun control happens from, oh, state of emergency, we just have to temporarily limit your gun rights. And you go, now, excuse me, in this case, I don't think that's what's happening. What happened in Virginia was the Democrats took over the legislature and the governorship at the same time and said, okay, we're going to increase gun control. The good people of Virginia, you know, rose up and said, no, we're not going to put up with this. And so they went, we're going to march with guns on the Capitol. Oh, little state of emergency here. It's kind of more reactive, but it shows that bigger dynamic. And I would like to think that it's a beautiful example of the potential of localization to solve the gun rights issue. Because people think of libertarianism as pro-gun. And in a sense, it is. But at an obviously deeper one level back, you go, well, it's pro-private property. You have the right to own a piece of metal in whatever shape you want. I have no right to invade your person and tell you that you can't own that or your property and say on your own land, you can't have that if you're not hurting anyone. You have the absolute right to own whatever property you want, including the property necessary to defend yourself as you see fit. In public, same thing goes. I have no right to tell you can't own. If you're in public, fine. The flip side of this, though, is that if you want to ban guns on your own land, in your own home, you absolutely have the right to do that. If you come together with a bunch of people on private property in a community and say, we don't allow guns in our community. I mean, I don't know how you're going to enforce that, but you know, maybe only state agents are allowed, or only our whatever, however you do it by contract, by expression of your private property, you're allowed to do. If you want to live in an area where guns are banned, you should have the right to do that. Now, you can't force that on anybody else's property, but on your own, and with anybody who you can get to live with you, around you, who wants to live in that, you know, great. And in Virginia, you see the sanctuary counties issue coming up. Hey, we want to live in a county where gun rights are respected. You don't care. You get to live in a county where gun rights aren't respected. I would rather see that in my ideal world happen at the really atomized ethical community level, not county by county, but county by county is a great start. And as I've said, we get rid of the federal government, you're going to see states racing to get dissolved down to the county level. And at the county level, you might have city states break off. But at the county level, as libertarians, we're kind of done. When government is that small, that local, when you can break off and form your own community.
Right. Your work is you've done your job at that point, right?
Yeah. And it's very exciting how the recent events in Virginia are kind of illuminating that.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, that is kind of a good point. Like, I was pretty when they announced the bill that they might be, you know, confiscating without a grandfather clause, I was like, oh shit, dude, it's gonna be real. But then when I saw the you know, basically the response from the different counties, they deputizing all these, or like, you know, at least, you know, threatening,
they're not gonna get away with that.
Yeah, exactly. No. So I mean, and we got this protest on Monday. I'm actually going to it to interview people and to try to cover it, and that's what he basically declared state of emergency for. So just, you know, pretty interesting thing, right?
Well, maybe you can take this as an opportunity to insert localization here, like challenge. Right. There are a lot of gun owners, again, who become this idealist, impractical, you know, activist saying, well, no, I have to have a right to carry my gun on my back, on my hip, everywhere in America. And it's like, yeah, I agree with you, but don't you want to respect people who want to live in a gun-free zone, right, and take that? Like, I'm not going to live there. But if they want to have that in their county, like, or their community, wouldn't you respect that?
Yeah.
Now, just to be clear on the extreme, you know, like I said, I'm part of the tribe, and I see the fringe white nationalism in the United States is genuinely disturbing. My grandparents fled Hungary in order to avoid World War II. Mm. But I can still say, like, okay, you want an ethno state. You want a little white nation over there. If you form it on private property, you don't force it on anybody. So you create it ethically. You know what? I'm not going to live there, but I wouldn't be allowed to, I guess. But you know, like, if you want that, as disturbing as that is, I want you to have that right. And on the flip side, you're a gun grabbing socialist who wants to live in a nudist commune out in the woods. Cool. I'll take my entertainment value from a distance. I'm not going to live there. But I want you to have that right. And that's why localization is the everybody gets what they want,
right,
strategy.
Yeah, I mean, then it seems like that's a fine alternative. It's, you know, when faced with the alternative of just utter control, you're not allowed to discriminate in any way, no freedom of association, you know, it seems like that's, you know, you'll take that, right? You know, as long as all groups, and again, you're disbanding the federal government. So it's not like the federal government will even have a say in calling a group. You know, that's one of the funny things. It's like a lot of these things don't have a strong definition, you know, Jewish, white, black, socialist, you know, all of them are subjective to a point, you know, not completely subjective, but But you're saying that, you know, when you disband the federal government, there could be, you know, I don't know, call it, I don't know, North Dakota could be the white state, and there could be a black state. And if they want to, if it's voluntary.
I don't think it's going to happen at the state level. I think it's gonna happen at the county or more local level. Okay. that people have.
All right, gotcha. So, you know, I guess for the remainder of our time, we'll just talk, you know, 2020. So you're running in the Libertarian Party. You're making a run at the debates. You're going to go to the convention in Austin. Yep. All those things.
Yep. Yeah. Really looking forward to it. We had Tennessee last weekend. We got Georgia this weekend, and then basically zigzagging all across the country for the next few months. And I should point out that you cannot vote in the Libertarian primary unless you are a delegate at the national convention. Now, I have to explain that there are some states that hold primaries. They have almost no bearing. There are 1,000 delegates at the national convention in May in Austin. They are all super delegates who get to vote for whomever they want to be the nominee. So this really is a matter of turning out people and showing the activist leadership within the Libertarian Party that localization is the best strategy for the party, especially in 2020. Now, I understand that without a black swan kind of event, no Libertarian is going to win the presidency in 2020. And we have a number of shots that we're taking at making a black swan happen. You're not going to get a black swan running another Gary Johnson type candidate who's socially liberal, fiscally conservative, and, you know, has respected mainstream electoral experience. No, that's not going to change anything. But we have Victims of Family Law for Kokesh, very excited about this vibrant coalition group that we have. I'm a child of divorce myself. I don't know anybody who hasn't either been a child of divorce, been right through a divorce, been affected by a custody battle, been affected by an ugly divorce, or been afraid of government interfering with how they raise their kids, even to the point of kidnapping them because they smoke pot. You know, it's insane. If we could get every American who's been bullied or shamed into silence on that issue to stand up as a victim of family law, we wouldn't be putting up with that for much longer.
Wow.
We have veterans and military for Kokesh. You know, 22 veteran suicides a day is a national embarrassment. Any presidential candidate who doesn't have a serious plan for addressing that should not be taken seriously. And in my platform, we spin the VA off as an independent institution, get the bureaucrats, politicians out of the way, and give it directly to the veterans. It gets an endowment, and every veteran in America gets one ownership voting share. You end the drug war, let us medicate how we see fit without your bullshit restrictions. Hmm. Cannabis, psilocybin, MDMA, some of the most effective treatments for PTSD made illegal still. I might have had my life saved by cannabis by avoiding pharmaceuticals when I got back. We have what was the other big coalition group? We have exotic entertainers for Kokesh, stoners for Kokesh, Christians for Kokesh. And a lot of these represent potential black swans, where if the American people were able to realize how we are all affected by these fundamental issues, and that getting government out of the way would be critical to addressing and solving those issues, we'd see some radical shift. Mm. But without that, and I really think this platform is the most important one, you know, winning the nomination and getting this idea on the main stage. I think that is the ultimate black swan to say, hey, the American people have a real choice in 2020. America doesn't need a president. We're too good for this government. We could have nobody for president for real and have a practical way of achieving this that's better for everybody. So without any of that, I think that you still need a platform that gets people's attention to have a breakout year for the Libertarian Party. And our realistic goal is to get 10%. I think we can build on Gary's 3.25%. Like I said, I don't normally vote, but I'd come out and vote for that. I think we get a lot of traditional non-voters to come out and vote for this platform. We get a lot more independents. And I think that adds up very easily to 10%. And that sets us up for victory in 24. Because every day between 2020 and 24 that the federal government screws something up, I'm sorry, the last part of that sentence was unnecessary. Every day between 20 exist, and 24, yeah. I get to be the one to say, hey, if you had voted for us, that agency wouldn't even exist right now. So I really encourage everybody to get involved in order to win the nomination. We've been doing a lot of fun stuff, a lot of great media appearances. Just got featured in the Washington Times. I've been on Fox a couple times recently. And we're breaking through with this message into the mainstream already. But we need to stay laser focused on raising money and winning delegates in order to win the nomination. So anybody who can donate, you don't have to remember how to spell my funny last name. You can find everything through thefreedomline.com. Of course, Stephen, of course, very responsible, is going to have all the links available. But thefreedomline.com, you can get my book there for free in every digital format possible. Join the email list at KokeshForPresident.com. If you can get involved with this campaign as a delegate, most states have yet to select their delegates to go to national. It's a relatively simple process. Show up at your state convention, show up at national. Send me an email if you want to get plugged in, adam@thefreedomline.com. adam@thefreedomline.com. Got to repeat stuff. And so I really appreciate the opportunity, Steve. And of course, if you have any follow-up questions here, I don't have to go just yet. But I do want to say in wrapping up here that what you're doing with this is so important. I'm a big tech optimist. Technology is fundamentally empowering. The internet is a game changer. We face so much censorship now on social media, with Google, with YouTube. But what you're doing is so critical, because this technology means nothing without deliberate, conscientious use. So anybody who's listening right now, put your money where your mouth is, or rather your eyes and your ears. If you like this interview, I hope you'll share this. But if not, share Stephen's work, support this production, support independent media. We need your help. We don't have subsidization by the military-industrial complex. We need active, engaged audiences to make this possible. So thank you, Stephen. And thanks for everybody who's watching or will be watching in the future for making it possible for Stephen and I to do what we do.
Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate the kind words, and I definitely like what you're saying about the 10% goal for the libertarian. I think I've heard it from a few different sources, basically, that, you know, what is a libertarian candidate doing not being a radical these days? I mean, what, like, the fiscally conservative, socially liberal thing, that's just playing to, like, the milquetoast side of each side of the wings that the libertarians are supposed to be, you know, the third leg of the stool or whatever. But it just seems like, you know, Gary Johnson, you know, I voted for him. I wish I wouldn't have, to be honest. I would have liked to see more of a radical at the time. And certainly this go round, it's like, just what is the libertarian candidate doing not being, you know, some sort of radical position, right?
Yeah. This was my opening monologue on the podcast last night, was, is libertarianism radical? And I kind of want to separate, because that word is used to demean libertarianism, to belittle people as extremists. And radical really just means striking at the root of the problem. Mm. And if you're not radical, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Striking at the branches? No, strike the root. And the question then is it extreme or not? Well, if it's the root that we're talking about, the fundamentals of human ethics, if what we're talking about is extreme, it's because the status quo of government has gotten so extremely divorced from basic concept of freedom, of human ethics.
Yeah.
So in that sense, if you want to say I'm an extremist because I'm advocating for peace, then you're saying that government is extremely violent. Okay, I'm an extremist.
I'll take it. Yeah.
If you're saying that government is the extremists and we're just the practical ethicists trying to make the world a more just, free place for everyone, then we're the moderates, they're the extremists. It's just a matter of bullshit political framing. But radical, yes, we should absolutely embrace this term of striking at the root of the problem, because there are so many great activists out there distracted by this issue, that issue, you know, and you win an inch from government and they take a mile behind your back while laughing at you. You know, you got cannabis legalized in your state, sort of, maybe still paying ridiculous taxes on it that are now being used to fund the police state, the surveillance state, the military adventurism, the military. It's just, no, you strike the root, right. Not the branches.
Wow. Well, yeah, I guess I just have one final kind of quick question before we get out of here. I was really excited to talk to you today. It was a great conversation. But what is a sample day in the life of Adam Kokesh look like? You know, like, you're on the road. So like, you still put out YouTube videos. So like, what does a sample day look like?
Yeah, I wish I had a more consistent answer to that, because I keep writing daily routines. Okay, I'm going to go to bed at 11. I'm going to wake up at 8. I'm going to do a little bit of yoga and meditation, and I'm going to make my tea, and I'm going to take my vitamins, and then I'm going to do my podcast prep, and then I'm going to record a podcast, and I'm going to have all my audio and videos up and done, rendered by noon, and then I'm going to get to make phone calls and do campaign stuff all day. But that it really is a much more haphazard version of that. So, for example, today, right now we're doing the podcast Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So I'm just doing a little video editing, video posting, doing an interview, you know, with you in the middle of the morning. I'm at my fiance's family's or sister's home in near Cincinnati. So while she's doing laundry, I'm going out and running a couple errands. And then we are pulling steaks here in the middle of the afternoon, to go out and start driving towards Atlanta. We got a 10-hour drive over the next 2 days. So today it's go to the gym, run some errands, and get a few hours of driving in so I don't have to do a full 10 and a half hours tomorrow. Then tomorrow, get up, and actually have to be on time, on schedule tomorrow, get up, do the podcast, get it done and out in the morning so that we can do the rest of the drive to Atlanta. And then there's going to be a little reception there. Any state convention that does Saturday, Sunday, you know, there's some little pre-party Friday evening. So if not, we're going to be hosting that here in the bus in No Force One, outside the hotel. And then it's the convention all weekend, and there's a debate. There's, there's the business meeting. There's talking to people there, and then it's back on the road. And then we got a jam. Like we got 3 or 4 hard days of driving to get all the way from Atlanta to Tucson, Arizona for the Arizona State Convention.
Wow. So it's just grind, just hustle, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I mean, I love it.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't do it any other way. And then, you know, the only other thing is I miss my homestead. You know, I miss being able to wake up and be surrounded by trees and nature.
Right.
And do some construction, get my hands dirty every day. So when I'm at home and I'm not touring, it's get up, do a podcast, do media stuff, and then spend the afternoon doing construction work. And then in the evening back to, you know, writing or, you know, working on books or longer term projects. But no, man, I love it. I love this life. I have a great fiance by my side right now. We're looking forward to getting married in a few months and starting a family out there, living off grid and changing the world. But yeah, I love it. Thank you for, you know, giving me a platform for this, but really to everybody who makes it possible. You know, I get some money through Patreon and sponsorship and merchandise and all that, but it's really the donations to the presidential campaign and my various activism endeavors that make it possible for me to live this kind of awesome life.
Wow, man. Well, it's such an honor having you on, man. I really appreciate the talk and thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks to everyone out there for checking out Call Me Ignorant today. You can find this uploaded to YouTube, BitChute, and FreedomScoop.com as a video, and Apple, Spotify, and Google Play and Podbean as a podcast. Please subscribe and follow my channel in the various platforms. If you feel like you've benefited from the show, you can leave a review over there on iTunes or Spotify, or you can share the show with a friend. I hope everyone out there enjoyed the show today. My guest was Adam Kokesh, who is running for president in 2020 as a libertarian on the platform of dissolving and localizing the federal government. You can find his information over at thefreedomline.com and also linked below in the show description. Everyone out there, have a great day. Go inform yourselves.